And welcome to the Dice and Screaming Podcast.
Arr, indeed.
All right. Hey, I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
The originator of that roar, by the way. And hey, welcome to the Dice and Screaming Podcast. Hey, we're here today to do some genre exploration. We're going to explore the spy genre and talk a little bit more directly about games. This has been coming up a little bit because, well, hey, it's a... It's kind of a lost genre for role-playing. Not many people really focus on an espionage era, but there's a lot of film, movie, and other media, including obviously some very popular novels with an agent with a serial name. 007, yeah, we're not contractually bound. We can talk about it all we want. This is for review purposes. But yeah, there's a certain guy by the name of 007 who looms large in when you mention spies. It's probably the first one you thought of. Maybe you thought of some other ones. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So we're just going to get right on into it. So
I obviously thought of Archer.
So. You, well, of course you would. But that's the other
kidding,
part.
I'm kidding. I kid. Well, you can expect no less.
Uh-oh.
From the shoe phone of gaming podcasts.
Oh, so that's how you're going to play it. All right.
Hey, it's an appropriate one. It, Maxwell sure. Smart, for those of you who do not remember, Maxwell Smart, look it up.
Yeah, so prepare
missed
to be...
it by that much.
Yep. Good old Buck Henry's best time.
Don Adams. Yep. Masterpiece.
Right, but we'll talk about that as well as many other functions of the genre and how it applies to gaming. So... if you're ready, so we're going to tear on into it. So we're going to just start right off with the elephant in the room, which is 007. And the spy genre grew out of kind of a popular men's fiction of the time. Novelizations, short stories that were written by Ian Fleming, who was in an ancillary method, a intelligence gatherer, an agent, a sifter through various... the Enigma codes and other such things. He basically was a correlator of information and would basically put it in front of people with take all these diverse sources and bring it to a conclusion. Well, it was as we would call an analysis these days. They had a different name for it in the British intelligence services. But
the most important thing is that in the course of those duties, he ran across a number of interesting personalities. Over the years, you know, he had both interaction with and read reports of and from a variety of extreme characters. And a conglomeration of those like traits and characteristics from the most outrageous field agents, you know, in some case, double agents, became the basis for his building a character known as James Bond, like an amalgam of all of these, like almost cartoonishly amazing things. And the fascinating part is that a goodly portion of them were quite real. Like,
yeah, just... he spent a lot of time, Pavel Uznov spent a lot of time in Brazil, just schmoozing it up with various political figures of the day. Spending an inordinate amount of time gambling and womanizing and drinking, but yet still managed to come up with pertinent information, leaks that he was able to discern in his, their moments of weakness at the Argentinian and Buenos Aires consulates.
Never underestimate the value of a cocktail party to national intelligence.
And then went back into Spain so to do more of the same. Anyway,
yeah,
so he put several characters, these together, and sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. Like, you know, nobody will ever believe this.
Yeah, I actually have to scale this back, because this will just seem like, you know, pure fantasy.
Now, so, of course, he did do over the top, but...
Now, it must be said, like the elephant in the room there is that the... Ian Fleming's novels were like just masculine fantasism. Okay. I mean, if you feel like some of, you know, gaming is just power fantasies. Oh, look, we're amateurs at this, like the spy action thriller novel genre is like the master class in just adolescent power fantasism. And yeah, complete with the purple prose that you might expect. So by today's standards, they really don't, I don't think they would have become the thrillers that they became had they been done about 35 or 40 years later than they were.
Well, the Cold War would make a perfect setting for the cloak and dagger or skullduggery or whatever you really want to call it, the espionage genre, to be, find a good home in. Because, well, unlike the Hot War that was World War II, where there was an active conflict going on and secret agents were more... we've seen it, the rise of it in World War I with Mata Hari and some others, more luridly trumped up cases. Strange that they focus on Mata Hari's, excuse me, I'll get it out one way or another, Mata Hari's sexual exploits rather than her actual contributions to her her benefactors.
Yeah.
Intelligence. Oh, yeah, she slept around. Yeah, but she also provided a great deal of information. That's pretty much what it is. But, yeah, they...
That's the, awkward embarrassment of a bunch of people who fell for the honeypot.
Yep.
Over and over again. While she just sits back and goes, I literally have no idea how this keeps working.
But you can also look backwards. Like,
literally, I walked into that building and everybody knew what I was going to... Oh, she's going to seduce somebody and then she's going to get information out of them. And like, everybody knows it. Like it, like, oh, well, that's what she did the last 20 times. And then she walks in and somebody's like, okay, yeah, I'm in. Yeah. Just, wow. All right. How? How does this keep working? And yet it did. But, so,
right.
You know, so it is what it is.
You could actually look back to the American Civil War. You can also look back to even to the 1600s, Sir Francis Bacon, to the beginnings of espionage as an organized activity. But the black rooms where they used to open up...
spies have existed in perpetuity, like dating back.
Napoleon like used a... there's a guy who quite resembles 007 if you remove some of the technological trappings. As well, basically fighting and gambling and schmoozing and boozing his way into the good graces of foreign diplomats, Adolphus Gustavus and all that. So yes, you can look back, but where it really peaks and what we're going to focus on is primarily that one time, specifically from the late 50s to the mid 70s. And that seems to be the place where most of these role-playing games really focus on. Now, there is a case to be made for the modern spy genre, which is more typified by Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise and all that. And we're not going to get into what you think about Tom Cruise. He's an actor, and some of the movies are better than others, but the Ethan Hunt series of Mission Impossible, it's not bad. It definitely puts the modern spy genre into the pop culture references, and some games have picked up on that as well. So let's top it off right here to start us and focus up. The games that we're probably going to be talking about is primarily Top Secret, the TSR version. There was later an SI version for the later, but that was still also relevant to this one, although a little bit updated. The Danger International / Espionage from Hero Games, which has the strange Danger International has a strange affectation of having Anton Chigurh on the cover. Back before, when he was working for more or less unsavory means for drug cartels. But yeah, if you get that reference from No Country for Old Men, you win the no prize. All right. So, and then also Mercenary Spies and Private Eyes, as well as the Spycraft role-playing game. And probably a few that we did mention, GURPS, but there might be a couple others out there that we missed. I'm sure somebody will tell us that we missed them, but we didn't do it out of malice.
It was the actual James Bond game.
Well, yeah. And that's where I wanted to start off with is, but there is one that stands above the rest. Okay. And you just mentioned it, which was James Bond or Her Majesty's Secret Service. And these games have two things in common. One of all is that they're small, meant as small groups, and they were almost solo games. So we're going to start out with Victory Games coming out with James Bond, Her Majesty's Secret Service 007 role-playing game.
And it was understood that there were really only going to be two or three people in the room, and that, like, under certain circumstances, you could possibly anticipate a fourth or fifth person, but that was highly unlikely. That was the entire game was pointedly designed to engage a smaller group of players. And I feel like part of that era was an understanding that while D&D could gather a group of six people to a table on a reasonable number of nights, the games that were not D&D had great difficulty doing so. And here's a game that leaned into it and said, yeah, like, you can play this with just two people. Like you wind up with your other players missing, you should play this game.
Right. And so this game was primarily meant, when we talk about one of the big factors in here, James Bond, and we start out with this one, we talk about that as one of the big factors that really looms large. But it wasn't as successful as one might have thought. Other games like Top Secret seemed to capture the genre a little bit better with people because they were meant to be more diverse. And there you go. One of the big things was James Bond, or in Her Majesty's Secret Service role-playing game. James Bond was a little larger than life. He was a more powerful character. He was supported by a whole organization of MI6, along with the Q Division, which basically technology is plot device. You were given a couple, like, direct things that worked to get your characters out of trouble. Like, here's this one device that you may not see any use for, but will actually come in very useful in this adventure. So, and James Bond was just like, yeah, don't bore me with the details. Just give me the stuff. I'm out of here. And then later we're like, wow, that really came, you know, that ejection seat feature on that Aston Martin really came in handy. So I thought it was just silly, you know.
Yeah, having the lighter that's a grenade and the walking stick that is a, you know, a combination of blowgun and a welding torch. It was just, yeah, I did not see that coming in as handy as it did.
Yeah, pretty good. So, yeah, that's a big thing. But let's shift back to the genre for a minute, shall we? Let's talk about one of the big things that came out of James Bond, which was his nemesis, which was Spectre.
The shadowy organization of intentional evildoers and chaos bringers, which the core concept of has lingered in popular fiction ever since. The idea of organized evil. You're literally seeing the Protean beginnings of one of the most popular tropes in multiple genres. And if you want to be go a little sillier with it, like, it's a guild of calamitous intent.
Yes, or, you know, the... get smart, you know.
Okay, yes.
But yeah, Spectre stood for Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion, which, you know, it was written primarily as a behind the leftovers of the Nazi Party who meant to do harm and other rich millionaire or super billionaires, as they would be these days.
Well, failed plutocrats. Yeah, like anybody who had ever made a bid for, like, I shall have absolute power over this nation. And then I was crushed by everybody else who didn't want
failed plutocrats, new rising rich that seen themselves above dominion or reign. That's who Bond was playing against. And so rather than just having a Cold War espionage, he decided to spice it up by having a fictitious organization behind it all, pulling the strings of both sides. It was multinational. Encompass both the CIA elements, the CIA, the KGB, even MI6 was compromised. You know, they had agents inside there. So they had their fingers everywhere. And of course, you would see that in a comic book form, Hydra. But we don't want to get too far in the superhero one, but that's a popular one. And even with G.I. Joe and Cobra.
Yeah. The idea that you cannot be absolutely certain at any time that your organization is completely immune to the influence of insane amounts of money wielded by people who have no intention of, abandoning their pursuits. Like, they will say, no expense is too great to achieve their goal, and they have the means by which to achieve it. So the constant self-guessing, I've got to keep tight lips because I never know who's listening. And even if it's like, well, only our people are listening in this building. Yeah. And that's still too many for what I have to say. You know, that sense of you're always under the gun. You're never, ever truly safe. And you are always on the job.
Right. And that's one of the defining things of the genre, that subtle but ever-present paranoia. So besides organizations, the prevalent sense of paranoia and that time is of the essence, that there is a pressure on you, really captures the imagination. And I think that's why it translates so well to gaming, is because that sense really resonates with players.
And the clock is ticking before the nerve gas is released. You know, just that.
Right. You've got 3 days to recover these nukes from Thunderball, or we have to adhere to Spectre's wishes. We're going to have to pay them.
They will ransom the world for $1 million.
Well, for, for inflation.
$1 billion. Sorry. Jesus, throw me a bone here, people.
So, as we talk about that, there's also another one. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Now, of course, yes. U.N.C.L.E., The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Was by Thrush, so posed by Thrush. And, Napoleon Solo. What a name, huh?
Yeah. Oh, fabulous names they gave to some of the most oddball of enemies. Napoleon Solo, not Napoleon Dynamite. he's not here to give you a delicious bass.
Yeah, and U.N.C.L.E. was the United Network Command for Law and Enforcement. Whew, what a mouthful, huh?
Yeah.
But Napoleon Solo, and they had some Russian Ilya Kuryakin. I think I'm getting that one wrong. And they were battling Thrush, that international evil syndicate. And again, here we are with the movies versus TV. The TV version was okay. Maybe they had an effects budget of $2,000.
Yeah.
And so they had, they would show the same stock footage of what, like, if they go to Hong Kong, like, you see the same junk in front of the Hong Kong skyline with the airplane landing, and it's like, okay, yep, same stock footage recycled over and over. Boy, that little ship has been through more pictures. That captain should be like getting royalties for that. But yeah, they would have that little white, fade, and then he's in Hong Kong, they play the silly little song.
Yeah, the absurdly racist
oversimplification. Or if you went to something like Portugal, they'd be playing some, fancy music,
Although I am forced to admit that, consider their target audience. Literally, if you don't sledgehammer them with something, sometimes it's like, wait, where are we again? I've lost the thread. Oh, my God. Toddlers after eight bowls of cereal that was extra sugary. What? You're like hummingbirds.
Yeah, and Thrush stood for technological hierarchy for removal of undesirables and the subjugation of humanity.
Yeah.
Shoo! Boy, they worked overtime on that one, didn't they?
Whoever we hate needs to die. And we, just for the record, we hate almost everybody.
But great actor, he made do with the part he was handed. He just really did a really good job of portraying what essentially was kind of an absurdist look, you know, for weekly syndication. You had to come up with a world ending plot, you know, or something dynamic to get him involved. And so some were going to be better than others, but you know, he was, look, they cast well. Robert Vaughn, say what you want about him. I mean, you know, maybe like William Shatner, you know, maybe a little bit of a ham on screen, but he played well to the part, and that's what they wanted. They got what they needed for that, and it made it work. I think that, for my money, Man from U.N.C.L.E. and another TV show, if we can pause for a minute on this one, is Mission Impossible. Now, Mission Impossible, I think, was a lot tighter written and had a recurring cast of characters. And that encompassed, I think, what more the Top Secret was going to do. Where you could kind of like, hey, if I wanted to just rub some serial numbers off, Napoleon Solo could be played in with Her Majesty's Secret Service or the 007 role-playing game.
Yes.
Because he's a little larger than life. He's a, you know, he's dynamic. It's focused on one central character moving the plot with occasional help from his Russian friend. Oh, okay, so anyway, I'm going to leave that one on the floor then. All right, low hanging fruit. And you're still making that face like you don't know. Okay, I guess it didn't land. All right, moving on. We had you could have that character do it, but now turning to like Mission Impossible, each one was like a small game. Like, you could do worse than just watch some Mission Impossible episodes and write down like the intro from the tape recorder. Like, Peter Grace would come in and like, here's, you know, this guy is trying, this despot in South America is trying to blackmail this United States into giving up nuclear secret codes to a foreign nation. And he has this professor who has done nuclear research, and you have to extract him without alerting them that you have replaced him with a body double, which will be provided to you from the morgue. And yeah, you have to do this. And so they assemble a guy, cast of characters. Martin Landau was quite a frequent player on that as well. Barbara Bain. And of course, oh my goodness, I'm terrible on this one. The guy who played Sam a lot. End up playing Colonel Ty in Battlestar Galactica, the original one.
Hmm.
Yeah, but that cast of characters was obviously recurring over and over again. And, you know, each one had a specialty. Like, you know, one was a face man, master of disguise, an actor, a con man, an improvisationer, and Barbara Bain, the honey trap. So you had this cast of characters. So that made it more like Top Secret and Spycraft as well. Although I would say that Spycraft probably has more to do with the new Mission Impossible. But hey, you could just sit back and watch some episodes on the Oldies channel of Mission Impossible and crib notes off of that, and you would have an entire campaign of Top Secret.
Yeah, honestly, you could go to IMDb and just read the episode descriptions.
Even better.
Okay, like
thank you.
Referencing a modern way you can access free and immediately.
Yeah.
I recommend watching them, like track it down, you know, via whatever streaming service is necessary to find such dated material, but maybe a parent or grandparent who has it on video cassette.
Oh, or a DVD.
Yeah, like the DVD era also was pretty generous to us before, like, the awful realization dawned on people that, like, oh, we can steal so much more from them if they never, ever own an actual product, and we have total online control over it. So now, like, yeah, tons of stuff is just completely unavailable. But the material is out there. But IMDb is a suitable substitute. Just reading the episode descriptions for some of the shows we've mentioned would provide you with espionage plots galore. Like, literally years of play. You'll never get through them all.
No. Oh, by the way, that actor was Greg Boris. He played the... he played the engineer or technical support guy, Barney Collier, was really good at engineering and electronics. And Willie Armitage. Apparently, I was just looking through here. Not only did they have like Leonard Nimoy and Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill took over for Peter Graves, or was originally there, I think. Oh. Yeah, he was really there. Stephen Hill, might know him from Law and Order, maybe not. Sam Elliott was also a cast member. Wow, I didn't know that. But yeah, so yeah, there was a diverse cast, and they did change it up quite a bit. So it did seem like there was more than just a few people used. But of course, the ones that they used the most were Martin Landau, Barbara Bain, Peter Lupus, and Greg Morris. They were almost always there.
Well, of course, Mr. Graves.
Well, yeah, and Sam Hill. Those were good actors. But nonetheless, as we reminisce, we're right back to the core point here. These land solidly on how to do a group game, where each character will play an integral role at some point. Some more than others in certain episodes, of course. Barbara Bain's character in a direct hit on somebody. Yeah, she's going to be the distraction. She's going to go in there and, yeah, she's going to seduce the target and distract them while they go in and do a setup so that they can off them.
He's a middle-aged businessman. Oh, boy.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, which means, like, literally his brain is, like, you know, 89 to 95%. Whoops! Oh, my gosh! Whoops! And you know what? The tragedy here is that that's so not far from the truth. I mean, that as I was mentioning the honeypot, you know, like it being ridiculous that this scenario works as well as it does when everybody knows what it is and knows what they should be laying out for. Like, it's a known quantity. Everybody knows it. It still works. It is still in use in espionage to this day. It works because, let's face it, guys are just dumb as crap. I mean, it.
All right.
I'm going to directly reference Space King, which.
Space King.
You know, just the. Hey, Mulder, how come you weren't distracted by her awesome boobs? She's an alien. Okay, so Hate Monger's gay. Now that means that I'm not gay. Okay, it's ridiculous that it works, but it does. So now while we might go, it's a very silly trope, it's a trope that works. It's really hard to feel merciful. You're like, oh, these poor guys have been duped. At a certain point, you kind of have to ask yourself, weren't they just literally thrilled to be duped? Like, oh my God, I really
well,
hope
that's
somebody,
it. They're over.
I would really love
part of that somebody, Ian Fleming.
Yeah.
Major flaw of the villain is overweening pride. Everybody makes the trope like, oh, the villain's going to like, I'm going to kill you now, Mr. Bond, with this ingeniously contrived device that I'm going to explain its function and disarming of. Don't follow me. And presses the button, you know. It's like, it can only be undone by this particular way. And don't do that. And then runs out. That's it. They're so convinced, sublimely, or self-deception of their own brilliance and ingenuity that they can't help but brag. They can't help themselves.
Well,
and that's the flaw that we see repeated in real life. They just, real life villains, a lot of times cannot help themselves from bragging. They've got to do it. It's part of their dysfunction.
Yeah, the narcissism, dark triad, like social maladjustment is such that if they don't have bragging rights for what they've done, then there's no point in having done it in the first place, which makes them differ from the actually, you know, in many ways, far more dangerous creature, the absolute true believer.
Mm.
That, like, they don't want, it's not for credit. Like, they truly believe they're willing to be absolutely quiet about what they're doing, and that is why they are 10 times more dangerous. Whereas the almost cartoonish modern villain, which in both reality and in fiction, shoots their mouth off at every opportunity, it has become a trope for a very accurate reason, much like the honeypot, okay?
Yeah.
Because it is hauntingly reminiscent of the conduct of actual people. But I did want to mention, a couple of other things, but we will hit that after the break.
All right, we'll catch you then. So stick around. All right, we're back, and we're talking about spies and stuff. So yeah, spy genre.
I wanted to, like, not to drift too far into the fantastic, but I wanted to take a little sidestep, is that the trope has become so normative.
Well, which trope are we talking about?
The one that we just left off
on. And we're talking about villains, right.
The villain outrageous conduct. It has become such a common trope that the exception to it is considered a particularly masterstroke move or a really interesting spin of the genre. Now, The Watchmen is the perfect example. Like, do you really think I would have told you my plan if there was even the slightest possibility of you affecting the outcome? The missiles were,
right.
Like,
and
this was activated 30 minutes ago. There's nothing
you to be done with a certain.
If you're going to exercise that trope breaker, it has to be done in the right place and time, because like absolute helplessness or total failure does not make for good gameplay. Now, it made for a great movie.
Or comic. It's not a movie. It's a comic.
The graphic novels were amazing. But,
right. It was that exclamation by Ozymandias.
Yeah, Ozymandias. You can't have, like, the world's smartest man. Oh, what a total dumbass.
Dumbass.
He had to have a plan that was better than the average plan. So none of that ridiculous, histrionics. Like, I'm here to make a magnificent display of my awesomeness before completely failing and being forced to flee. yeah. Damn it. It's my third volcano lair this month.
Well, you might want to consider cutting back a little bit, not broadcasting so openly. But hey, you know what? That's a thing. But yeah,
I had to put in for new minions.
So to sum it up so far, for those just tuning in, we've been talking about the tropes of the spy genre. Inarticulately and as they come to us. So we were talking about the organizations like Uncle, Spectre, and
Smersh.
Well, Smersh was real life.
Yeah.
That's what it was partially being, the committee to crush foreign espionage or spies or whatever nonsense they put it up to, versus the Central Intelligence Agency. It was always an alphabet soup, wasn't it? And the specific genre that our times zone that it was that these seem to take place, although it's not 100%. It's mostly 60s and 70s because it was very popular. It captured a lot of people's imagination. The Cold War was at full boil and everybody was, very nervous. So seeing some kind of, like, everybody knew that there were things happening behind the scenes in real life, but this was more glamorous, and real spy work, real spy craft is kind of boring. And it's not as exciting as you would think. Although Ian Fleming did prove that there were exceptions to that, but...
Well, wartime was, quite a bit different. On-the-ground field work was nerve-rattling and terrifying. But the long process, the more real process of, sifting through...
Analytics,
A large number of reports... You've got this coming in from over here, and this coming in from over here, and this coming in from over here. What corroborates the other? Like, the most awkward lesson in espionage is that nothing is worth its face value. Like, zero corroboration means that something might as well be fiction. You have no idea. And if you take action based on every rumor you hear, you expend an enormous amount of effort, clearly indicate to the world that, they will now know what you are listening in on and what you have access to. And further, you can easily be lured into taking action that is, counter to your interests. So the process of corroborate involves a ridiculous number of intersecting personnel and sources of information that can back each other up. So building those kinds of networks, it's not the stuff that fantastic novels are made of. Okay.
Right. Let's face it. That's the grounding of the real spycraft in effect. However,
in real spycraft, if a gun even went off, then everything else has already failed. Like that.
Yeah, there was a couple daring missions in real life where they had to rescue an agent or extract a double agent.
Yeah.
And those were hair-raising and white-knuckled encounters that could potentially escalate tensions that were already oftentimes strained at those times because you relied heavily on those people. But, you know, the Ames spy ring that was in the Navy for a number of years.
Yes.
Not, those guys were not glamorous in any way, shape, or form. And actually, the KGB is like, wow, what idiots.
Yeah. You
know, we were prepared to pay them a lot more, but they took the first offer. What a dumb, what a, so much for capitalism, huh?
Yeah. seriously.
Where the few Russian sleeper agents that we had deep inside that were double agents, they were doing it for ideology. And yeah, they did like the money, but they knew that they couldn't spend too much of it, so it was pretty much worthless to them. They were being watched all the time, so if they started suddenly living extravagantly, yeah.
Yeah, it would be noticed.
Yeah. So, yeah, they were doing it more for ideology, which, hey, you know, I think is what it is.
But yeah,
we talk about those things just to give a grounding. So they're not as exciting as, like, 007, you know, busting through a window or getting out of a death trap or, you know, seducing the Bond girl, which is another trope.
Using a can of aerosol deodorant as a flamethrower.
Yep. Well, yep. Hey, you know. All those things led to that kind of excitement, and that was with the 007 role-playing game. Now, in we talk about a little bit more grounded ideas from, well, because the budget wasn't there, was The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Even Get Smart has some pretty clever ideas.
Yes.
There's a lot of humor, and if you need to spice it up with some jokes, you know, Buck Henry's a great writer, so he did a lot of that along with Mel Brooks. Was doing the Get Smart, going through all the elaborate processes to get into to do his job in the morning. I mean, Maxwell Smart, you know, they had to walk through all those things. And sometimes they wouldn't work. That was the thing, is you never knew what was going to happen. And that is another trope, one we're going to dismiss, but it is worth mentioning, is the Bond girl. That's a whole thing, and I think it's more specific to the movie, but also it has its ties deeply into the men's adventure fiction of the time, which, hey, you know, there's a whole podcast on that from Behind the Bastards. Look it up.
yeah, I mean, do you like porn but don't want to actually admit that you like porn? Like, you want something that's, like, on that borderline that, like, does certainly more than hint at it, but isn't as incriminating on your bookshelf as, like, just having a stack of Playboys? Then you are looking for men's adventure, action, thriller, espionage fiction.
but
I'm kidding.
But
marginally.
We just want to talk about it when you talk about Ian Fleming or 007. It does come up. I think the new 007 movies with Daniel Craig have a much more mature and nuanced look at the Bond girl, but also, like, yeah, she dies and gets really depressed. Which happened in the novel when they killed his wife, real life. And he was, kind of like, I don't want to do this anymore. So there's
this is why I can't have nice things.
Yeah, I can't have nice things. And then, of course, if we're going to talk about Get Smart, Mike already did it for us. He already advertised Archer pretty well. So you'll keep hearing about that as we go along, I'm sure.
well, the humor genre, including Get Smart and Archer, is the trope itself, you know, acknowledging that it's a trope. There is so much lateral room in which to have fun with the genre. And I actually recommend that people, like, you know, do you really want to, like, do, like, our super serious game is super serious? Like, get those smiles off your faces and roll those dice. Do not lift your eyes from this table unless it is to roll the dice at your appointed moment. Yeah, fun is prohibited. No, throw that whole attitude out. It's okay. Inject a little humor into it, but, like, don't make it a laugh fest. You don't want to just, you know.
Well, I think that humor is always going to happen at the table no matter what. But, you know, there is a certain.
A fine one to
if
talk.
If you want to play tune, play tune. But if you want to, like, you could use tune is so versatile that you could literally play Archer with tune. And, you know, that's pretty much, you know, the hit points are not
yeah, but
pratfalls there. Actual physical damage. So, but hey, you know, just remove that role, tunes that. So, but the more important thing to remember is that no matter what genre or what kind of inflection you have on it, and it's going to involve a lot of these tropes, and that's what we want to discuss. It's not any one defines the genre of the spy espionage, genre to be. That's what we are talking about genres, right? Yes. So, yeah, the overall is defined not by a singular one of these, but by a group of them. So we have the organizations, we have the time, and the technology is a plot device. That deserves a little bit of talk. In a lot of other games, we have magic items, and nobody thinks anything of that. You know, like a potion of invisibility or cloak of elvenkind. Man, those can be pretty good, right? But are plot devices that get you through things. I mean, imagine poor Frodo and Sam trying to get into Mordor without their cloaks of elvenkind. That would have been a much more hair-raising episode, huh? A short trip to the Halls of Lament for you. And
a more recent example of a obvious example of the espionage category being re-explored with, you know, action movie stylings, and a little bit of humor, The Kingsman. Now, obviously, I like the first one best, as I think pretty much everybody does. You know, not such great outings in their later movies, but the novelty and enjoyability and charm of the first movie was off the charts. I thought that was a terrific outing in the espionage, spy thriller, action comedy. It literally had it all. It was that perfect intersection of all the things that I go to a movie to enjoy. And man, it had it in spades. So I was suitably impressed. But, you know, it tells you that, like, people are still occasionally nailing it. Like, it's not just the old grandpappies of the genre that are being invested in. Every once in a while, some smart new kids pop in and do something cool. Mm-hmm. Which is terrific, which tells you that it's a living, evolving genre. Now, people do get a little crusty about any alteration to James Bond. Some people get upset over things that I don't understand, but I understand that impulse because, I'm sorry, I'm still upset about the Heineken, okay? Daniel Craig and his Heineken. Because somebody managed to outbid, like, for their product placement. So instead of a martini, we got a Heineken. And I'm like, really? Really? Ouch. Like, just, man.
You know? Well, at least you have something tangible to.
But he was a fantastic.
Focus on, as opposed to a lot of the other people.
Well, he was a fantastic Bond. So, like, no, I'm not going to crap all over Daniel Craig or the movies that he was in. Because were they amazing to watch? Yes, they were. But like watching that Heineken was like the only cringe moment.
Well,
just my whole soul shuddered like, ew. Oh my God. You have absolutely failed.
Anyway,
back on track.
So, yeah. So, anyway, we've spent a lot of time talking about 007, and I want to focus on now more of the direct correlations of how the genre has managed to find its way into gaming. And from a lot of our gaming experiences in the tabletop, let's discuss a little bit about the top secret game and its use of bureaus, like the Assassination Bureau, was the 00 Bureau. Each one had like a classification. There was confiscation, administration, which was the Game Master's. Yeah, the Game Master actually had a character, although without stats. The Administrator.
Yeah, like there can be many different administrators. The important thing is that, like, this is who sets the mission parameters.
Yeah, they're the person behind the voice recording.
What constitutes success or failure? And success can include things that are more challenging than merely, like, we have achieved this first goal. There may be other parameters that have to be met. And that was the responsibility of the administrator.
Well, the administrator was just basically a name for the Game Master.
Yeah.
But the fact that the Top Secret game fully embraced the genre Although some of the early rules were a little clumsy, we can look past those because, hey, you know, it was like, we're going to have a different system to do this thing. You come into the Calvin ball sort of area of game design on that one.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was the 1980s.
Well, sure, it was one of the first attempts at it. It was one of the first, but whereas the Victory Games 007, Her Majesty's Secret Service game, was a lot more... it was very focused on one particular character and one specific brand in the genre. And so they were able to micro-focus on that, and that gave them a good deal of grounding, like the Q source book, you know, like this is all kinds of stuff that you see in the movies, plus some stuff we just dreamed up. Now, there were different administrations inside, bureaus inside the business, as it was called. And so it was up to the game master or administrator to come up with whatever it was. But yeah, assassination, confiscation, and oh my goodness, what was the other one? Oh yeah. Hey, wake up, Wikipedia, help me out.
But the division of bureaus allowed them to break down the topics in a way that let mission types and styles be planned according to the kinds of challenges that you were most likely to face. So,
investigation. That was the one I was.
It was
reaching
a novel
for.
Concept. Okay, for its time period, it was absolutely new. There wasn't really a whole lot to go on. Okay.
Right. And so instead of having classes, you would belong to a specific bureau. The assassination, you start, you know, you're a hitman, you were the 00. And then, of course, you know, each one of the adventures had a little dossier to hand out to the players, some nice little handout maps. And it was very specific. It was more, in this one, I think where they kind of went off the reservation on this one was they started to focus primarily on pseudo-scientific stuff. Merle Rasmussen kept him on course as much as they could with, like, a lot of his each adventure would be named Operation Executive One, you know, which was, you have to rescue the president. That was a terrible adventure. You can salvage it by changing it from the president to a administrator NPC, and I think that would be better. You know, somebody has been compromised and we need to get them back. You know, they're going to obviously use very foul methods to extract information from this person. So do an Operation Rapid Strike, which was by Mike Carr, and Operation Sprechenshaltenstelle. Yeah, try that one out. And some of the other ones. But they also had one of my favorite ones, which was Dr. Yes. I love Dr. Yes. I love that operation. Which was in, it was called the Floating Island Mission. It didn't have the Operation Rapid Strike code name to it. It just had Dr. Yes. And, of course, it was a gender flip of Dr. No. It was a Swedish pharmaceutical who was trying to infiltrate the pharmaceutical or illegal pharmaceuticals with psychedelic and LSD that could change minds to her radical point of view. And, of course, you know, lounges around in a slinky dress and all that, but on a floating island, nonetheless, complex. Man, that is daring stuff, and that is some high-flying spy adventure. And
yeah, you should come over and visit sometime. I was pounding DMT with Joe Rogan last week.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, there were some other ones in Dragon Magazine, including one of my favorite ones, which is Wacko World, which was basically a theme park that was a... hideout for several sinister organization spies or counter spies to use here, so you had to infiltrate it. Which kind of resembled some of the stuff that was going on with Roger Moore James Bond. So I think that, like, when you talk about serious business, they've always had a tongue-in-cheek, and especially Roger Moore, I think, with his 007 played that up. But I think Archer also borrows very heavily from Roger Moore's kind of sardonic sense of humor with his slight sadism, cutting his tie off. The guy hanging on by his tie just cuts it off. Ah! and then, you know, it's a retractable tie. So, yeah, that's cool.
Have you, there's one that we haven't mentioned yet, but I really wanted to mention because it was time period relevant. If we're speaking of like 1960s, 1970s, you know, spy genre, we must remember the Avengers.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That's a good interjection. Yeah, because I was trying to tie it up with the technology as plot devices and how that worked with magic items. I think we got a little off track with trying to gather up the genre. And as we do, we, you know, gather up things. We find, oh, new shiny. So, yeah, this is a new shiny.
Well, that's the joy of, like, we're still in the habit of really hustling through these longer sessions because the material is so vast.
Absolutely.
The 1 hour time limit was prohibitive. And, you know, we also got to take a breather and remember we don't actually have a time limit. This is our meta narrative. We will go as long as we feel like it. Deep breaths, relax, well, enjoy.
Sure. But also, you know, focus, you know, and is proper because to land one point and then move on to another one. But yeah, the genre with technology as plot devices is always defined it, and that's going to be the changing one when we want to talk about spycraft. And of course, we talked about Top Secret. I think embrace the whole genre quite specifically with the Danger International, which I'm not as familiar with. But if it's a hero system, it's a point build, so you know you can create any super agent from. You don't have to have just the specific Victory Games 007 role playing game. You can just.
I don't know that one either. Like I know the name.
You can just sit. Increase the point build and have a better secret agent than if you're just having a few players. And that would tie in nicely with the Avengers. And I think that puts us right in the firmly place of talking about before the transition point of from the classic spy genre to the modern spy genre. The Avengers was a TV show on the BBC before it was the Marvel Universe Cinematic MCU.
Speaking not of the Avengers, you know, Marvel thing. We're speaking of the television show, which, I mean, if you're looking for, like, I would almost argue, like, 65 or 70% of the inspiration for Austin Powers, you know.
There's another shiny. Yeah, Austin Powers, Archer.
But, you know, why are they making fun of these tropes? This is where some of those tropes came from. And it's one of the earliest examples. I literally, you know, like on the heels of the success of like the very first Bond film, like this nascent spy genre began to explode rapidly outwards. And man, like right at the heart of that, the Avengers.
Yep, which was Patrick McNee in his bowler hat and umbrella, Irrepressible. And then, of course, Emma Peel, which was played by Diana Rigg, and then in her cat suit. But for the male viewers of the audience, Emma Peel. You
know, why is she always dressed in skin-tight leather? Because it's awesome. Like, literally, what else do you need? Like, why are you questioning this? Are you just literally trying to take away my happiness? No. It was trope. Right. And it became trope. People mock it, but it was absurdly popular at the time.
Yeah, and they weren't so much about espionage as they were also solving crime and investigation. So
yeah.
In this one, Emma Peel is more the action character, and Patrick McNee's character is more the intellectual, the social situation, as she is not just the honey trap. Yeah, she does occasionally act as a diversion but it's because she knows that her targets are gullible and easily duped.
Yeah, the wonder of it is that is not the limit of her talents.
Right.
So, you know, like it is all of her other abilities that are more relevant to the plot. Yeah. So that was a nice change of pace, which is why I really did want to get this included in the mix, because again, for its time period, in the context that, you know, would exist at that moment in time, it was quite the forward-thinking little project.
Yeah, it definitely put him in a more, the male protagonist, in a more subdued role. It was more subtle. it was implied that his character had ties with the British intelligence, that he was occasionally, they would be contacted to do work that they felt uncomfortable doing because they were more...
He was a valued asset.
Yeah, and Emma Peel's character was more of a ancillary person that he knew that could get things done. She was a martial artist. She was a lot of things at the same time. He was a lot of things. He was more of a... rather than being a buffoon like Clouseau, he was more of a Hercule. Very civilized.
Hercule Poirot.
Poirot, yeah, I didn't want to massacre that, so thank you. More of a character like that. I'm terrible at pronunciation. So.
Or Mycroft and Sherlock Holmes. You know, the background planner who, you know, very carefully thinks out, you know, like that 27th chess move before the first pawn even moves.
Yeah, and again, it's a TV series, but it's just like Mission Impossible. This was well done. Not all the episodes are particularly great ones. You're going to have a few duds here and there. Some of the ones that just land a little flat. But they're all pretty well thought out. Again, they understood what their operating parameters were, and they kept inside that and didn't try to overreach too much. Which I think hurt a little bit of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. But The Man from U.N.C.L.E. also sometimes was kind of goofy. And, you know, it just worked that way. Kind of like Doctor Who in a way. But it was unashamedly so. So I don't think about that. But during this time, I mean, we had a lot of options. But The Avengers was one of those rare ones. Like, it wasn't as popular as some of the ones we've mentioned before. That's why we kind of forgot. It doesn't loom as large.
Yeah, the BBC stuff was only available on, like, the oddball channels in the middle of the night. It was one of those, like, serialized things that it was very hard to stumble across.
Yeah, it was an ITV thing. Whereas ABC
Mission
up.
Impossible had been so successful that, like, you could get late night reruns of it on major channels. So we had access to that as a kid.
And it's just as a trivial note here, The Avengers is ranked number 17 on the top 20 TV Guide's top cult shows.
Yeah.
Because it has such a great following. Because
is why I really had to get it in here. Yeah, it seems like I urgently interjected this at the wrong segment of the show. I did. That is a factual and accurate, you know, notion. But it was like just...
See, these are the type of rabbit trails we want to go on.
It's too relevant to this topic to have missed entirely. I would have been ashamed if I didn't include that one. And hey, we may miss some stuff, but at least I got... like foundational material in.
Right, and we'll be moving on to the transition point, but we're going to take a quick break, so you need to stick around. All right, we're back. Hey,
let's hit this technology issue here.
It's a plot device, you know, back in the day, you know, they would give James Bond, like, hey, this is briefcase with these special levers on it, and if you enter this combination, it will release a spray of nerve gas into whoever. And, you know, he's like, geez, I don't want to forget that number, huh? and then he uses it to great effect. Yeah, it's a good, there's a lot of gags like that. Plus, there's also Man from U.N.C.L.E. had a lot of little things like he would get. And, of course, we talked about the shoe phone. And now we have portable phones, but, you know, at the time, him taking his shoe off and talking into it was absurdly comedic.
Well, Maxwell Smart driving a desk through town.
You know.
And it's got machine guns.
I know.
It's so much awesomeness. It was the best comedy you could get for that level of expense.
Yeah, that amount of hilarity. The attack desk. Yep. Finally, the administrator gets to enter combat. I've been waiting for this for a long time. Paper pushing my ass.
But yeah, technology has changed over the years. Okay, some things have radically altered. So one of the risks with that is that if you're in a time period specific type of gameplay, the tech feels very clunky and cheesy to the modern player. Because honestly, you know, we live now 40 years into the future. I didn't get my jetpack or my frickin' flying car, but I'll tell you what, in terms of international global communications devices, everything has changed. What is possible is like infinitely beyond anything we imagined.
Well, back then too, like, oh, we're in Macau and we're interrogating a person who only speaks a limited dialect of Taiwanese. Okay, but that's Chinese, right? Yeah, but it's a limited one that was inhabited to the Isles. Oh, I just whip out my Google Translator and look it up.
Yeah. Problem solving in the 21st century is not as egregiously difficult as it was even 20 years ago.
Now, so, to their credit, like the top secret has been revised. We talked about the SI and we talked about... we haven't talked about the new version, which is called New World Order, but yeah, he's brought out a new version. So it encapsulates some of the more dynamic changes of technology, as well as spycraft, which was reared in the early 2000s. Well, what a wild time that is. Man, we'll have to talk about the internet of the 2000s sometime.
Oh my God.
That was crazy.
It was the Wild West.
But you could do this with Danger International. I mean, it's a point system, so you can just create gadgets however you want. But the one thing that encapsulates this is another humorous opinion, of the spy genre, which was Austin Powers, where you have the major villain and protagonist, antagonist and protagonist, set squarely in their timeline.
Yes.
Even in modern times.
Yeah, even having been plucked from their original timeline, the brilliance of the concept and the fun of the show is not that it's technical perfection or that it's the greatest written thing ever, but it has transplanted that late 1960s shtick directly into the 1990s. And it's the out-of-place nature of their classic rivalry done in the style of their time period. And yet everyone else, like everybody who has moved on from that era, is, I don't get it. We could not get sharks with lasers. I'm afraid they're endangered. So that was a problem.
Yeah, but Dr. Evil gets one over on his son every once in a while, doesn't he?
We got... some very angry mutant sea bass.
But right, but you see this in focus with Archer as well. Now, Archer kind of likes to place itself in a nebulous timeline. Archer dresses like he's from James Bond in the 60s, or if that's the only style guide. But yet, you know, it's in the modern times with smartphones and high-end computers, and as well as information gathering techniques. Satellites.
Yes, the Archerverse was very specifically created to allow Cold War rivalry and a mixture of both modern and clunky older tech. And it even pokes fun at itself regularly. Noting that, like, the computers and... like telex machines are like outmoded methods of communication. But oh my gosh, it does have a tongue-in-cheek, wonderful sense of humor about acknowledging that it is using multiple tropes that should be incongruent in the modern world. Like if you were setting this at a very specific time period, this would fail. But they intentionally, like, let's have a blurry zone that is unique to the Archerverse that allows us the leeway to use all of these concepts at the same time. That's a tricky thing, but if you're playing a game and you want to be able to make use of all these tropes, it's worth thinking about and maybe harvesting the Archer approach. Because leaving aside the comedy, the point is that they manufactured a Archerverse.
And also with Kingsman and...
Thank you.
Austin Powers. Although Austin Powers is a little bit more dopey.
Yeah. But they're engineered to allow access to all of these things at the same time. That's not beyond the administrator or gamekeeper's power. If you do a little design time and think it think it through fairly carefully, this is perfectly acceptable.
Right, and no matter what vehicle you're using to make your espionage games with, what we're talking about here is a style guide for espionage role-playing. And when we go to the modern games, and Mike's a little less familiar, but SpyCraft in the early 2000s came out with under the Die 20 license.
Oh,
a pretty well-made game with a lot of
Yeah, I'm not material. Super familiar, but I did get like several chances to peruse that. I just never got to play it. But it was.
Yeah, they have like some well classes organized. And like, so yeah, it's very well organized. It's pretty tight, although a little clunky because using the 3.0 system. But hey, you know, it's still viable. There is a little bit of convoluted power build, but that's just what it was at that time. Some of the third edition feats did get excessive, especially at the high end.
But that it was
we're gonna cut
it wasn't a game breaker. It was still a good product.
Right. It was focused to what it wanted to do. And they tried to keep it very tight in that aspect. So multi-classing was really appreciated. Or it's almost a near thing. So like to get a James Bond character, you would have a combination of almost four different character classes. But nonetheless, no matter how you slice it up, it was a pretty good approach to it. And it had a 60s source book. So you can definitely do the, you know, mission to a moon base, because that's a thing that was in there. It's like if you thought Moonraker was a little extreme, and yes, it was. It was way off base of the novel, but it at least incorporated the names of the villains as well as what they were after, you know, to start civilization over again. And that was one of the big things that they were putting in. Great film for the character actors, but a terrible film for the genre overall. Like,
yeah,
I just wanted to have the MOS when I entered the Marine Corps with saying, can I be a space shuttle door gunner? Because that seemed like a pretty flippin' cool job in Moonraker. Take that. No, we don't offer that. Wait, it was the United States Marine Corps, Space Marines. I mean, come on. What we got to do, right?
Cracking skulls, looking for Space King.
Okay, so but we talk about these as transitionary genres, like Austin Powers, which is played a lot for laughs, but there is something there. There's a lot to mine from that, and this is what you do as a game master. It's like you don't like say, I'm going to play Austin Powers, the role-playing game. No, you don't design that. Oh, I really like stuff that is an archer. Well, okay. Archer is a little bit more seriously souped up, but it still has kind of like the smart ass, like wisecracks that come out in the middle of combat or, you know, that happen at the table. So I feel like a lot of affection for that one. You might be able to do something with the archer game, but that's just actually a... If you played a SpyCraft top secret game really well, these are the kind of characters that would develop from that. You know, like if you just wanted to go completely ham, like my character is really, he's a clone and he's was raised in a test tube born in a test tube and raised in a very specific environment with very narrow senses of interest. Okay, Krieger. Yeah, that's exactly what you get. And, you know, yeah, it gets strange from there. And it only gets stranger. You can go off the deep in that. And Archer, you know, who is just a study of...
You're not a real medical doctor. Technically, I'm not the other kind of doctor either.
I don't know what you do, but he does know what he's talking about. I think what I like to talk about Archer is, like, we'll go back to the Man from U.N.C.L.E., is Ilya... Kuryakin, and he had what was self-diagnosed as a volatile personality disorder, a KGB assassinated who was traumatized by his past from his father, who was caught stealing from Joseph Stalin's party funds and exiled to Gulag. And then, you know, of course, his raised without him, his father came back completely distant from him. Yeah, he had all these issues, and they took this and kind of gender swapped it with Archer's mother, who looms large. And, you know, besides in the Freudian sense, what you get from the Freudian father absentee, now you deal with the mother, which apparently, you know, has even more issues according to Freud. But Archer shows every one of them. And so he's this deeply flawed. He has low self-esteem issues. He's haunted by a guilt complex. You name it, he's got it.
Narcissistic alcoholic.
High functioning alcoholism to deal with his conflicting attitudes and personality disorders.
I did like the development of the character later, though, where there was some acknowledgement made that, he's not completely unfeeling. He just, has a massive avoidance of accountability issue.
But Kuryakin was just, he had that volatile personality disorder, and it really manifests where Napoleon Solo was a little bit more smooth and was trying to work things over. He was like, no, enough talking. Bam! Punch him in the face. Wow. Well, all right. Well, hey, you know what? This worked out.
Building characters that have dynamic personalities that do not perfectly match each other. It's writing.
Exactly. Just like with Emma Peel and, I keep forgetting his name. John. Patrick Meaney. I know the actor.
Yeah.
Character. There was an interplay, even a sexual tension, because male and female, although some people do pick up on what I was saying earlier about Kuryakin. Fanfics aside and plot shipping, there is a lot of relational dynamics between them that push off one another. And besides the sexual tension plot points, there's also that they remained completely platonic throughout their entire relationship in the Avengers, whereas also performatively so from the Man of Uncle. Sorry if I ruined that for you, but Man of Uncle fans out there, but yeah, that's a whole thing on its own.
Those men from Auntie.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. All right,
the gay fan cartoon from 30 freaking years ago or 40 freaking years ago now. The genre was a hit.
We talk about these things. You take what you like and leave some of the others behind. We had to talk about the popular episodes, of course, because of TV shows, franchises, the movies and novels, as well as comic books and cartoons. And, each one of them is a love letter to the espionage genre as itself, because real life spycraft is boring. Real spy stuff is mostly looking at photographs.
Yeah, a very large number of photographs and reading a very large number of documents and listening to a ludicrous number of recordings, and then summarizing them and then handing all of the summaries to the person who tries to connect the threads between all of the summaries. Yeah, it is excruciatingly dull, which is honestly...
Ian Fleming was daydreaming a lot during it.
Yeah, you've got a lot of time on your hands because magical, amazing stuff is not going to happen anytime soon.
So,
and if it does, that means that everything went horribly awry. It's the worst of all circumstances. I do want to mention a couple more recent entries, the Jason Bourne.
That's where I was going to go. And that kind and of is a bridge. That's a bridge between the old, because the novels were written a long time ago.
Yeah.
In the genre that we're talking about, the 60s and 70s. And then the movies updated them. And that is a great way.
And of course, Tom Clancy is another example of...
Yeah, a little bit more military adventurism.
Exactly. But geopolitical conflict resolved through military adventurism. So there is an espionage connection in many of
those novels. Absolutely. Yeah, and also technology. The gizmos, that really are real. They're real. Magnetic propulsion system on a Russian sub? Yeah, they had it. Not like, of course, what it was, but yeah, they had it.
Yeah. Quite real.
Yeah. They had a push jet propulsion system, which really didn't work that well, but it wasn't run on magnetics anyway. But I digress. Anyway, that's an area of expertise where I have to occasionally nerd out. But Jason Bourne, the movie series, even though it had Matt Damon in it, he did spectacular.
Matt Damon. Had to do it.
Yeah, you always have to do it because.
But he was awesome in him. I had a great time watching those movies. I'll poke fun with the South Park comment there, but the truth is that first
Team America. Well, that leads us to Team America World Police.
Yeah.
Even could be used, but we won't mention that in polite company. You'll have to see the extra cut for that one.
That is just like breaking wind in an elevator. Sorry, man.
But we could also talk about Thunderbirds, which was also sort of like that, but very fantastical in its technology.
Yeah.
You had a lot of different genres that are ancillary or tangential to it. Right there. You know, you can say like, well, they overlap a little bit in the Venn diagram. Maybe they dip in a little bit. But there's also something to say with like how like the Ethan Hunt Mission Impossible, which, yeah, Tom Cruise probably needs to not mouth off as much. But, you know, he has no F's given about the genre. He was simply here to do a job and he wanted to support his role in that and not be compared to somebody else. I think after, like, you're just like James Bond. Yeah, I am, but I'm completely different. No, you're not. But at the same time, I understand why you would occasionally get a little frustrated with being asked the same question 80 million times. But we come to, as the end, we talk about the movie genre versus the gaming genre. And the gaming genre is just this nebulous mass. And you take all this together and you're like, oh, what am I going to, how am I going to make any sense of this? Well, that's it. You just pick what you like. And you can come up with something like Archer or
plug and play, you know.
Right. You can take elements and like, hey, I like the Jason Bourne, but I want something a little bit more fast paced. Well, you can take and create something like The Kingsman and keep moving on through this until you get what you want. And you won't know what you want until you talk to your players. And that's the whole thing. It's like, as good as we can talk up the espionage genre, if people just aren't interested in it, you're not going to get anywhere with this as much. And yeah. So that's one of the big frustrations.
I don't think we have an answer to that.
Okay? No.
If you have recalcitrant players that are not interested in doing an espionage game, there's nothing you can really do about that. If you can pitch the concept... if you can pitch it successfully, then, you know, good on you.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the big cases about the original 007 role-playing game is that it was meant to be for a very small group. Maybe you just have a few people who are interested in this. And on an off time or off session, you can get this going. Maybe, you know, you meet on another day where these few players can get together and do it.
I do want to suggest, like, technique-wise, in terms of getting people to approach espionage, you may not want to open with espionage as your first pitch.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking to step outside the traditional, like, fantasy RPG, we highly recommend Call of Cthulhu, obviously, because we're both big fans. But it's a great step outside the fantasy zone. Now, that's much more mystery, horror, occult. But once you've coaxed people out into that world, it's less of a leap. Okay, this is not like going from the, you know, 75 degree, you know, like pleasant pool at a, you know, and then climbing into a boiling hot tub. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of like that slow temperature shift. You could get them coaxed into mystery or occult, and then it's a softer shift to make the leap over into espionage roleplay. So try it in stages and see if that works.
Yeah, and there's a mention to that about the 40s as also a genre hotbed of political intrigue, you know, punching Nazis in the face and all that stuff.
Two-fisted action.
Well, or shooting them in the face.
Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
Well, I was thinking more a la The Invaders from Marvel Comics, but, you know, that's a whole thing, too.
And I did want to throw in one last reference.
Oh, we've got plenty.
The Unknown Soldier.
Yeah,
there's The Unknown Soldier. It was all espionage missions for the guy with the, you know, no face of his own.
Well, yeah, this also didn't feel pain, so.
Yeah.
Ow. Bad wrong. That's all he had.
Well, that doesn't look good.
Nope.
You see, this is what I was talking about. You don't want that stuck there.
No. But so, yeah.
Let me take that out.
You've got multiple options. You also, like, with if you use, like, Call of Cthulhu, you can use other ways. Like, Call of Cthulhu is obviously an investigative role-playing game. And that's what I think you're trying to get some traction on there.
Yeah.
Like, you can get people interested in that. Here's something that uses the same sort of application of those techniques, but in a much more less fantastical, if you remove some of the crazy technology gizmos, environment. So, yeah, I mean, because then in that one, the technology in James Bond sort of takes the place of magic, you know, your potions of invisibility and all this stuff. That in a fantasy game makes espionage a little harder to pull off, but, you know, that spell rarity and stuff that we talk about, like making certain spells a little less common, can really take the edge off with the, you know, of having that tension of having actually, without Speak with Dead, well, murder mysteries are still a thing.
Well, keeping a lighter hand on the controls, always when you're dealing with these higher powered tech, like if it feels too deus ex machina, you know, big thing is it can only be used once, you know, classic trope. But this is your one out. And it, like, if you absolutely have to use it, this is all you get out of it. One charge. Like, oh, great. I got a wand of fireballs, but I better mean it when I use it.
No, yeah. Just give him a bead from the necklace of fireballs.
Yeah.
That would be pretty cool. Or just a really high explosive grenade. It's really powerful, but it's very small. Mm. All right. Well, we can work with that. Yeah. So however, whatever you want to do with the spy genre, as we talked about, there's different approaches, but getting people to play, that's the big hurdle for a lot of folks. And also the games that you want to use, you can still do it. If you really are, you really want to run espionage, yes, you can do it in D&D. You just have to be aware of some of the limitations with magic items, spells and all that. But, you know, it all depends on how much you include of these things. If you just don't put detect thoughts on the spell list, just say that, yeah, it's rare and you're going to have to work really hard to find a detect thought spell. But, you know, invisibility, that's easy to overcome. Not everybody has access to spell power. And if you have a whole bunch of, a whole group of mages doing espionage, well, we've got the wizarding world for you. So congratulations. You're infiltrating what was that doggone name for the mages bureau was suppressing the mundanes in the Harry Potter universe.
Oh, the ministry.
Yeah, the ministry, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, when they go in there, that's a pretty good way to look at doing a magical espionage. A lot of high tension being caught in that. Walk right in the belly of the beast on that one. The balls in that boy. Yep. But hey, you know, it would be the last thing they suspect, yeah, because hubris.
They'll never see it coming.
Well, it's true.
Fair.
They're hubris. It does. They never thought that this would be a thing that you could do. But yeah, so all right, well, I think I got a couple other ideas, but I think we're coming to the end of this, and I think we've beat the genre down pretty well, that nobody will ever want to play an espionage game after listening to this podcast. So we've succeeded in destroying the genre once again. But we have covered it before. You can look back, and we've also seen several other attempts that we've had of talking about how to do espionage and intrigue in your role-playing games. We've definitely talked about, like, recently about the heist, and maybe we'll be talking about that again as a genre.
Well, I did want to tap into one more vein, because sure. You brought something up just a moment ago with the concept of mixed magic and espionage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would suggest to people that if, like, that notion is appealing to you, I might throw out to you, look up the vintage 1990s comic book series, The Invisibles.
Oh, yes.
Which, oh boy, was that a psychedelic road trip.
Ugh.
Okay. Man, It's a piece of work. But you'll probably notice that there is some tertiary similarity to what eventually became The Matrix. And that is because the creators of The Matrix were reading those comics in the 90s at the same time that I was. So, yeah, there are some slight inspirations there of a world just beneath the sight of most people that they are unaware of. And then a certain clique of people having a grasp on what's actually going on. The ability to perceive what is underneath the apparent reality. So, yeah, marvelous thing, but magic and espionage combined. Interesting stuff. And I like where you went on that, is that, like, these are not things that are so exclusive and so precise that they can't be tampered with.
Or you have to definitely delve in. But what we wanted to talk about was this.
It'll help draw players.
Yeah, that the genre of the spy espionage influences, the spy genre, the genre of spy drama. I don't know why I focus on that one. But yeah, it's a thing that you do with a genre. And it was set squarely in the 60s and 70s. It was a very exciting time. But, maybe that time has passed and there's a different way of looking at it. I don't know if I have any answers on how to make it better for player to approach with players. If you just don't have people that are interested in it, find other ways to use it in different genres like fantasy and science fiction. Although science fiction is probably easier to adapt than fantasy per se. But I digress on that one. I think we've pretty much established that you can do different things in different games in different ways.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so you can do anything you want, in other words.
Yeah, no.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but yeah, it is.
Yeah, we're not the ultimate arbiters here. The real limit is, what's the scope of your imagination? But yeah, I don't think it's as hard a sell as people think. Yeah. Totally worth your time.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for us. And we appreciate you listening. Remember that Facebook group, The Dice is Screaming. You can look for updates and stuff there. You can comment on our posts and let us know what you'd like to hear or listen to. As well as, remember, on every other Saturday, we have Discord Night, and it will be no different this week. So Discord Night, usually at 7 p.m., give us an in p.m. on our Facebook Messenger, and we'll give you all the info on an invite. But until then,
may the dice always roll in your favor. We're out.
See ya.